Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 13. The Turning Point. In the Lynn Reporter of Saturday morning, February 3, 1866, there appeared this paragraph. Mrs. Mary Patterson of Swampscott fell upon the ice near the corner of Market and Oxford Streets on Thursday evening and was severely injured. She was taken up in an insensible condition and carried into the residence of S. M. Bouvier, Esquire, nearby, where she was kindly cared for during the night. Dr. Cushing, who was called, found her injuries to be internal and of a severe nature, inducing spasms and internal suffering. She was removed to her home in Swampscott yesterday afternoon, though in a very critical condition. There can be no doubt that Mary Patterson was badly hurt. Dr. Alvin M. Cushing, then one of the leading physicians in Lynn, when called upon to testify some 40 years later, declared from his notes taken at the time that when he reached the Bouvier's house, he found Mrs. Patterson partially unconscious, semi-hysterical, and complaining by word and action of severe pain in the back of her head and neck. He attended her through the night, and next morning, against his better judgment, but in response to Mrs. Patterson's earnest pleas, he arranged for her to be taken home. "As soon as I could," the account concludes, "I procured a long sleigh with robes and blankets and two men from a nearby stable. We placed her in the sleigh and carried her to her home in Swampscott." What Mary Patterson called home at that time was a little two-room apartment, which she and her husband had rented some time previously in the home of Mr. A.C. Newhall at 23 Paradise Court, Swampscott. The apartment was on the second floor, and from the bedroom window there was a welcome view over the treetops towards the sea. To this bedroom Mary was carried. Daniel was away, but Mary's active association with the Good Templars had won her many friends, and two of these friends, a Mrs. Carrie Miller and a Mrs. Mary Wheeler, came to her aid and took turns in watching by her bedside. They watched with her through Friday and Saturday. She apparently rallied in some measure and regained consciousness. But Sunday morning found her still practically helpless and in a condition generally which evidently caused those around her much misgiving. Dr. Cushing came and went, and then Mary asked for her Bible and that she might be left alone. We have no account of what followed except that which she has given us. Writing many years afterwards in an article entitled One Cause and Effect, she says, referring to this incident, "I called for my Bible and opened it at Matthew 9, verse 2. As I read, the healing truth dawned upon my sense, and the result was that I rose, dressed myself, and ever after was in better health than I had before enjoyed." This was the third time in her life that Mary had passed through a similar experience. Once at North Groton, when, after weeks and months of invalidism, she one day surprised old Father Merrill on his way to visit her, by running down the garden path with arms outstretched to meet him. once in Portland when Dr. Quimby told her she could be made well and would be made well. And now in Swampscott, as she read the account of Jesus healing the man sick of the palsy. Neither in North Groton nor in Portland had she been able to hold for long the new ground she had won. As she drove down the mountain from North Groton to Rumney with her sister Abigail, she was a wretchedly sick woman. And within a few weeks of her healing in Portland, she was writing to Quimby, begging him to come to her and remove this pain. It is not surprising, therefore, to find that the question whether this latest healing would not result as did the other two was the fear now that most sorely tried her faith. She was surrounded by doubt. "My friends were frightened," she has written in miscellaneous writings, "at beholding me restored to health. A dear old lady asked me, 'How is it that you are restored to us? Has Christ come again on earth?'" Mary answered bravely enough, "Christ never left. Christ is truth, and truth is always here." But then she goes on to tell how another person, more material, met her, and how she shuddered at her approach. And so, within a few days, she is writing to Julius Dresser and begging him to come to her aid. Quimby is dead. Julius Dresser was one of his earliest students. The man, in fact, whose healing had finally decided Mary to go to Portland at all cost. He could surely help her if he would. She writes to him from Lynn under date of February 15, 1866. And after telling him how constantly she is wishing he would step forward into the place vacated by Dr. Quimby, and how confident she is that he is more capable of occupying his place than any other I know of, she continues, "2 weeks ago, I fell on the sidewalk and struck my back on the ice and was taken up for dead. Came to consciousness amid a storm of vapors from cologne, chloroform, ether, camphor, etc. But to find myself the helpless cripple I was before I saw Dr. Quimby. The physician attending said I had taken the last step I ever should. But in 2 days, I got out of my bed alone and will walk. But yet, I confess, I am frightened. And out of that nervous heat my friends are forming, spite of me, the terrible spinal affection from which I have suffered so long and hopelessly." She is evidently very much afraid, and as so often happens, the more she wrote about it, the worse her fear became, until her cry for help is like that of a drowning man. "Can't you help me? I believe you can. I write this with this feeling. I think I could help another in my condition if they had not placed their intelligence in matter. This I have not done, and yet I am slowly failing. Won't you write me if you will undertake for me if I can get to you?" Julius Dresser, lately married, was at that time engaged in newspaper work in Portland, and had apparently given up all thought, if he ever had any, of actively pursuing Quimby's teaching. He replied to Mary's appeal for help with a few well-chosen platitudes, but made it quite clear to her that she could, in his opinion, do much more for herself than he could do for her, which was probably true. As to Mary's suggestion that he come forward as Dr. Quimby's successor, Julius Dresser is quite emphatic in his dissent. He expresses himself well, but it is difficult to avoid the thought that the cautious nature of his approach, combined with the character of his comment, may have had a profound impression upon Mary and unwittingly opened the way towards her own future. Whatever may have been her concept of the teaching of Quimby at that time, it is certain from all subsequent developments that she was continuing steadily that process of interpreting it in her own way and still unquestioningly calling it his, which she had begun almost at their first meeting. If a homely illustration may be forgiven, she took the Quimby shoes, and within a very short time she had soled them with the soles of her own fashioning, and not long afterwards she had remade the uppers. At this period, however, her whole thought was to find some means for carrying on Quimby's work. She had not yet, in all probability, had the faintest glimpse of the fact that the work she was destined to carry on would not be Quimby's. Julius Dresser's letter on the subject could hardly fail to make her think. As to turning doctor myself, Julius wrote, and undertaking to fill Dr. Quimby's place and carry on his work, it is not to be thought of for a minute. Can an infant do a strong man's work? Nor would I if I could. Dr. Quimby gave himself away to his patients. To be sure, he did a great work, but what will it avail in 50 years from now if his theory does not come out, and if he and his theories pass among the things that were to be forgotten? He did work some changes in the minds of the people, which will grow with the development and progress in the world. He helped to make them progress. They will progress faster for his having lived and done his work. So with Jesus, he had an effect that was lasting and still exists. He did not succeed, nor had Dr. Quimby succeeded in establishing the science he aimed to do. The true way to establish it is, as I look at it, to lecture and buy a paper and make that the means rather more than the curing, to introduce the truth. To be sure, faith without works is dead, but Dr. Quimby's work killed him. Whereas, if he had spared himself from curing and given himself partly and as considerately to getting out his theory, he would then have at least come nearer success in this great aim than he did. Whether Julius Dresser's letter really had anything to do with it, it was clear about this time that Mary first began to feel that the task of carrying on and developing further the work of mental and spiritual healing might devolve upon her. To turn away from any labor because of its difficulty or the hardship it involved was something quite foreign to her nature and to every instinct of her heritage. The Bakers always had been faithful alike to their virtues and their failings. It was up to her to succeed where Quimby had failed. If teaching and writing were demanded as well as healing, she would do all three. Certainly, her future shows that at some time or other, she reached some such decision. In her book, Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy puts the matter simply enough. Dating, as she always did, her discovery of Christian Science from this experience in Lynn, she writes that for 3 years thereafter, she lived a secluded life, so as to give herself entirely to the finding of a positive rule of practice. The quest, she says, was sweet, calm, and buoyant with hope. Conceding the basis of all harmonious mind action to be God, and that cures were produced in primitive Christian healing by holy, uplifting faith, she felt driven to establish the science of it all. She declares she did achieve absolute conclusions through divine revelation, reason, and demonstration. Her statement that the search was sweet, calm, and buoyant with hope must, in itself, be accounted a tribute to the efficacy of her faith. For it is hard to imagine 3 years into which more harassment could be crowded. Quite literally, she often had nowhere to lay her head, and much of the time endure a poverty on the borderline of destitution. History does not tell whether she ever renewed her plea to Dresser for help. Indeed, it would seem clear that, thrown back at last entirely on herself, she somehow met the demand. Within a few weeks, she is writing an article for the Lynn Reporter on the amenities of Swampscott in general and of 23 Paradise Court in particular. Mr. Newhall wants to sell his house, and Mary is doing her best to help him. But before the article appeared in print, Mary had set out on her 3 years of wandering. Daniel had somehow reappeared on the scene, and the two took rooms in Lynn in a house owned by a Mr. Russell at the corner of Pearl and High Streets. It was Mary's last effort to make her home with Patterson. He finally deserted her here, and although for some years he made her a small allowance of $200 per annum, paid in irregular installments after their separation in Lynn, he more or less completely passed out of her life. 7 years later, she secured a divorce from him, and some 20 years later still, after wandering from place to place, sinking each time a little lower in scale, he found his way back to Saco, Maine, where he was born. There, for a few years longer, he lived the life of a hermit. When Mrs. Eddy, then a wealthy woman, heard from his brother, like a voice out of the past, that he was in sore need, she sent him money, but she never saw him again. He died in 1896 in the poorhouse, his last resting place, the potter's field. To what extent, if at all, Mary realized that the separation was final when he left her in Lynn, it is impossible to say. But whatever her feeling, her actions from now on are the actions of an independent woman with a single purpose. At first, the Russells had received her gladly, especially Mrs. Russell. She thought her a wonderful woman. But by degrees, as was to come about in Mary's experience so often in the future, the strangeness of her teaching, when curiosity had been satisfied and it became apparent that real demands were to be made on life and conduct, began to arouse at first a mild resentment, but later positive offense. Moreover, Mr. Russell's father was a retired Baptist minister with very decided views, and it was not long before Mary realized that she would have to move again. She took a room in a boarding house on Sumner Street, kept by a Mr. and Mrs. George D. Clark. And it is here that a clearer view of Mary Patterson is to be had than has been possible for some time. Years afterwards, George Clark, Jr., who was then a young man, wrote his recollections of Mrs. Patterson, which are full of welcome detail, even to providing a diagram showing where each of the guests sat at table. As to Mary Patterson's appearance, she was now 45. But George Clark recalls her as a beautiful woman with the complexion of a young girl. He remembers that she usually wore black, but occasionally violet or pale rose in some arrangement of her dress. He remembers especially a dove-colored gown trimmed with black velvet that she wore in the summer. But what he remembers best about her is her way of talking and a little gesture she had with her right hand as though she were giving a thought from her heart. Describing her fellow guests, he says, "We were rather a mixed household and were 14 at table. There were several shoe operatives from the factories, a salesman or two, and a man who has since become a well-known bookmaker. The wives of several of the men were also guests at the tables, and conversation was usually lively, often theological." He also adds that everyone liked her. But Mary had among her friends at Lynn at that time quite a number of people more in her own circle, whom she knew through her family or through her association with the Good Templars. There were the Phillipses, a Quaker family, who lived near the Clarks on Buffum Street. Their married daughter, Susan, Mrs. George Oliver, who lived close by, and Mr. and Mrs. Winslow, people of considerable means, who had a beautiful house on Ocean Street. Both the Phillipses and the Olivers were well off, Thomas Phillips and George Oliver being prominent men in the shoe business, for which the Civil War had made Lynn famous throughout the country. It was in these three families during the summer of 1866 that Mary Patterson first apparently demonstrated to her own satisfaction her ability to heal the sick, for so she always thereafter spoke of it. During the time she was boarding at the Clarks, the Phillipses were her great resort. Mr. and Mrs. Phillips made her welcome at any time, and she came to call them Uncle Thomas and Aunt Hannah. She was particularly devoted to Mrs. Phillips, who somehow reminded her of her own mother, and as if to make the recollection of her early childhood's home complete, there was a grandmother Phillips, a devout old Quaker, well over 90, whose name, too, like that of Grandmother Baker, was Mary. They had long talks together, especially about healing, and Mr. Phillips would refer to them, jokingly, as the two saints. It was the healing of Dorr Phillips, the Phillips' youngest son, a lad of about 15, that Mary Patterson seems to have regarded as her first definite case. She had had instances of healing, of course, before that. There was the apparently clear-cut case of Miss Jarvis at Warren, but there seems to have been, in Mary's mind, some doubt as to whether such healings might not be, in some way, due to the master influence of Quimby. "I have healed her, and you have saved me," she wrote to him from Warren. But now Quimby was gone, and if she was to be saved from the dire effects of healing anyone, she would have to save herself. It is possible, of course, that she was already freeing herself, as she did, ultimately, completely, from this penalty doctrine of Quimby's method. But however that might be, the schoolboy, Dorr Phillips, presented a clear objective. There could be no question here of nerves or imagination. The lad was suffering from a badly infected finger, was in great pain, and had been for several days. There was apparently little that could be done to afford him immediate relief. Mary asked the boy if she might help him, and Dorr readily agreed. He had, no doubt, often heard Mrs. Patterson talk, and mixed up with his eagerness to get better was surely a tremendous boy-like curiosity to see if this strange thing about which he had heard so much would work. Mary seems to have had a good idea of the psychology involved. She made a bargain with Dorr and put him on his honor to keep his side of it. He was not to look at his finger again, or let anyone else look at it, until she told him he might. And he was to be a man and try not to bother about it any more. That evening, Dorr went over to his sister, Mrs. Oliver's house, to stay the night. His finger had not pained him all day, but when Susan Oliver wanted to see it, he firmly refused. He told his sister of his promise and how he was determined to keep it. When he came down to breakfast next morning, he had evidently forgotten all about his trouble, for the bandage was off, and when his sister drew his attention to the fact, and they both looked at the finger, they found it was perfectly well. Years afterwards, Susan Oliver became a Christian Scientist and eventually made her testimony as to the details of this case. After this, other instances of healing followed quickly. A young man from Boston who was staying with the Olivers was healed almost instantly of a fever which had reached the point of delirium. And Mrs. Winslow, who had been going about in an invalid chair for 16 years, was so far cured as to be able to walk unaided around her garden and even venture as far as the beach, so runs the testimony. The effect of all this was interesting. While it did not arouse resentment, as it had done in the case of Abigail, it did arouse what is perhaps best described as a sense of uneasiness. The Winslows thought it was wonderful, but begged Mary not to talk about it or attempt to go into it further. The attitude of the Phillipses and the Olivers was much the same. So long as it was all just an interesting phenomenon, they were glad to talk about it. But when it was put before them, as Mary was evidently beginning to do, as a new explanation of life and religion, which might have disturbing effects upon their accustomed convictions, they very definitely began to draw away from it. To Mary now, such a course was impossible. She did not break with her friends, but she began to look in other directions for an audience. She found it in the strangely mixed assembly at the Clark boarding house. Among the boarders interested in hearing Mrs. Patterson and taking part in the arguments on spiritualism and other kindred subjects, which provided a nightly feature at the dinner table and afterwards, was one Hiram S. Crafts and his wife. Hiram Crafts was an expert heel finisher whose home was in Stoughton, Massachusetts, a small town some 30 miles southwest of Boston. And having come to Lynn for the winter to do some special work in one of the shoe factories, he had found his way to the Clark boarding house. His place was next to Mary's at the dinner table, and although an enthusiastic spiritualist, he began from the first to listen eagerly to what Mary Patterson had to say. He had, of course, heard of Quimby, and it was still as an exponent of Quimby's teaching that Mary was seeking to make herself heard. And so, from taking part in the arguments at the dinner table, young Crafts sought more detailed knowledge. And after dinner each night, he and Mary would sit together, talking for long hours. Mary evidently saw in him, or thought she saw in him, an apt pupil, one who would at last go all the way with her. And she was unsparing in her efforts to help him. She not only talked to him for hours each day, but she began about this time to fashion from the mass of writing she had done during her association with Quimby some kind of systematized exposition of his teaching. This manuscript, or a copy of it, she handed in installments to Crafts for his instruction and guidance, thus beginning a practice which she seems to have followed generously for years, with ultimately bitter results to herself. Writing of these early manuscripts years afterwards in the preface to her book Science and Health, Mrs. Eddy says that they show her comparative ignorance of the stupendous life problem up to that time, and the degrees by which she came at length to its solution. She values them, she says, as a parent may treasure the memorials of a child's growth, and she would not have them changed. The trouble was, however, that the student not unnaturally took these manuscripts as the final word, and went off on his own to teach and preach a doctrine which his teacher was leaving rapidly behind. It took Mary Patterson many years to free herself entirely from the essentials of Quimby's teaching. And every manuscript of her own which seemed to perpetuate them came up in later years to cause bitter trouble for herself or some of her followers. But that is once again to anticipate the record. For the time being, all was well, and when Hiram Crafts left Lynn early in 1867, it was with the intention of giving up his work in the shoe trade and devoting himself to the further study of what he had learned from Mrs. Patterson and to the healing work which it entailed. He felt, however, that he was still in need of instruction, and he and his wife asked Mary to come to Stoughton also and make her home with them. Mary agreed. Many years afterwards, Hiram Crafts gave the details of the agreement reached between them. Mrs. Patterson was to have a room and board free in return for instructing Mr. Crafts, and Mrs. Crafts, as her share of the work, was to do the housekeeping for the three. Mrs. Crafts was apparently as earnest as her husband in her efforts to understand the new faith. And after spending the remainder of the winter in study, the little family moved to Taunton, another small town, a few miles from Stoughton. There they took a house. Mrs. Patterson furnished her bedroom and the front parlor with her own things, and the Crafts cared for the rest of the house and the garden. Most important of all, Hiram Crafts took an office, and having, with the gracious simplicity of those days, endowed himself with the proper designation, announced himself on the door as Dr. Hiram S. Crafts. At the same time, he inserted an advertisement in the local newspaper. It runs, "To the sick, Dr. H. S. Crafts would say unhesitatingly, 'I can cure you,' and I have never failed to cure consumption, catarrh, scrofula, dyspepsia, and rheumatism, with many other forms of disease and weakness, in which I am especially successful. If you give me a fair trial and are not helped, I will refund your money." Viewed in the light of today, such an advertisement makes strange reading. But announcements of the kind, even by regular practitioners, were then quite common. Moreover, Hiram seems to have been successful, at least to the extent that one grateful patient allowed her name and address, with a description of her cure, to appear in a later issue of Hiram Craft's announcement. In a small place like Taunton, such testimony could, of course, have been easily verified. And so all was well. Mary Patterson was absorbed in her writing, and it begins to be a matter of comment among those who came in contact with her at this time that she always carries with her a heavy roll of papers, steadily growing in bulk, which somehow, they gather, she regards as her most treasured possession.